We'd like to thank our patrons for supporting this episode of Registry Matters. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 179 of Registry Matters. What is up there, Mr. Larry, on a Saturday night? How are you?
Fantastic.
Anything exciting going on in the Larianators world on a Memorial Day weekend?
Not anything particularly exciting, just glad to be with our fabulous audience and looking forward to a short podcast. We're going to keep it nice and light.
Perfect. So we're finished right there. We'll just shut it down and call it a night.
Sounds good.
We were just talking in some pre-show about possibly some Patreon extra stuff. Let's tease some things maybe so some people would be inspired to come over and do some Patreonage for us. What kind of things might we talk about as some Patreon extra stuff?
We were talking about the immigration problem that would be easily solved and why our political system will not allow that to happen. The economy is being held back because we don't have the workforce that we need to do the work. We were talking about public assistance benefits and comparing those to social benefits of other types, and people who get a little bit larger check because they're on public aid and they have a larger family, and about whether that's good public policy or not. So we're thinking about talking about those. None of those have anything to do with the registry, but it's about public policy and how the formulation of public policy happens, which is directly related. Formulation of public policy is in response to the will of the people. So that's the correlation and the connection, but it's not directly on point.
Of course, of course. Then since this is going to be, it's kind of like a throwback to what we were doing, I don't know, 6 or 9 months ago. What are we going to do tonight?
Well, we've got a couple of questions, and we've got some articles, and we've got one thing to read from a prisoner who's trying to effectuate change from behind the walls, and we're going to give him a shout out for what he's been doing.
Excellent. Then I guess we will begin with some of these questions. All right, first question up is, I don't understand why you people don't have regular segments on recurring issues. I would like to hear more about early termination from probation petitions, removal from registration petitions, interstate compact transfers, and travel from state to state. I'll also add there, and as a personal, I see questions from people all the time about going to other countries. I know you've done all of these issues, but it's not consistent, and we forget. Would it not be possible to take a question each week on all four of these? My other observation is about the polygraph segments. It seems as though Larry is okay with polygraph testing and Andy thinks they are junk science. I would like for Larry to stop evading the issue and say where he stands on polygraph tests. Are they junk science or are they acceptable? It's a bunch to unpack there, Larry. Where do you want
there
to start?
Is. I think I'll start on the polygraph testing because they probably are junk science. But the reality is, they are allowed for monitoring people who are on supervision for the type of offenses that we deal with in many states. In particular, there's a statute in our state law that says it, and I think I've read other state statutes that says that. So whether or not they're junk science is really not the point. The point is how to best deal with the junk science, and what we've consistently tried to do is to help people understand how they can get through the process of the polygraph without getting themselves in further trouble. But I say that they probably are junk science. I didn't used to feel that way because they were always successful in our law practice. When we referred someone to a polygraph and they showed deception, they always confessed and admitted that what we thought they did is what they did do. But having talked to the administrator of most of our polygraphs, he said that they were no better than a flip of a coin.
If you go back, I'm pretty sure it's episode 2. So we had just started. I think the first episode was something related to AWA, I'm pretty sure. And then the second episode was about polygraphs. And if I recall right, you had a conversation that day and you were like, well, Andy, what just happened? I know what happened. So you had a conversation and then you decided that you needed to have a little bit of a change of mind about what the polygraph was all about and how it worked and all that stuff. But To that, Larry, I've also changed. Forget whether it works or not. I mean, like, forget whether the actual polygraph does anything. If you say someone showed deception on it, and then, oh crap, my video froze. And then if they cop to it and tell you all the things that they've done wrong, well, then I guess the polygraph worked.
Well, that's been my position, that if the person acknowledges that what we think happened did happen, and they didn't acknowledge it prior to the polygraph, what else could you conclude?
I totally understand. I got nothing as far as how to work my way out of that one, other than if you go take a polygraph and they tell you that you're showing deception, don't ever back down and admit to anything, because they're not, because I think from what you've said is you've never seen anybody that got revoked for showing deception or something along those lines.
I do not believe that anyone can show me a petition for revocation of supervision that says we seek revocation on behalf of the state because this person undertook a polygraph examination and showed deception, and then the petition stops there. If you show me that petition, I will admit it and say I'm wrong, but I have not ever seen one of those. You will show me multiple petitions that says the person showed deception on a polygraph, and at a post-test interview, they admitted to a plethora of things to the examiner and to the probation officer. That's a whole different revocation petition because it's not the polygraph that got you revoked. It's your admission and confession to violating your terms of supervision. I have seen petitions where people have been dropped from treatment because they've shown multiple episodes of deception, and since they have actually held their position and said, I'm telling you the truth, they've been dropped from treatment, and that has resulted in a revocation. That puts you
Right.
kind of in a catch 22. If you hold your ground and say, I'm telling you people the truth, but I can't explain your kabuki machine, and they revoke you, drop you from treatment and revoke you for not complying with treatment, you really didn't gain that much. So it's a terrible position to be in.
Yeah, I've told this before. A friend of mine was in treatment. This is years ago, and he was working for barely above minimum wage. Maybe it was $8 or $9 an hour, and he was doing very manual labor. And it was around Christmas time, and he's paying like 23% child support off of minimum wage or something like that. And they said he had to take a polygraph, and he said, I don't have the money to take one. And they're like, well, sorry, you're going to get dropped from treatment. And if I drop you from treatment, then that'll be a probation violation and you'll go back to prison. It's like, that's how, what are you supposed to do? So his probation officer gave him a 1 month pass, and he would have to take it like in January or whenever it was. That's ridiculous.
That's unfortunate, the reality of many of these regimes that they have. At last check in my state, they had provisions for indigent people where the polygraph would be paid for by the state. But I don't know how many states do that, and I'm not even sure we're still doing that. But at last check, that's what they were doing. But let's get on to the first question because my answer is real clear on that. I can't help myself. I'm not going to admit something. And if I've told the truth on the polygraph, I'm not going to change my story to satisfy the examiner's post-polygraph questions. So I don't know what else to tell you.
There's a couple other things in there. We have been covering these subjects, to me, almost to the point of the different areas that we cover a lot. I'm almost thinking that we cover them too much. I don't know that we need to. I don't know that I would feel comfortable that we would have enough content to do one every, all four of those every week, to do probation, petitions, removal, and all that stuff, to do that on a that consistent basis. But when they come up with something of a novel question.
Well, what the person's really angling for, and I don't know that we can do it because we don't have any lawyers, but they're wanting us to take particular questions from an individual who's facing one of these things. And
Okay.
I don't think that we can really do that effectively.
Like I said, I see questions on Reddit, and then you throw them in here. So I mean, I don't know that we could do it that. But anyway, if they come up, we're certainly going to cover them. But the whole point of this is, if you have a question about a thing and it was something that we already covered, then you could go back and listen to 10 or 20 or 100 episodes ago. This is like an archive of all of the current knowledge about what's going on in the registry world.
Well, I guess the point I would make on that is that if that were the case, then no radio station would ever be successful because you would just say, well, we covered that news story once today already. It was at
That's
7
true.
a.m. and therefore you didn't listen at 7, so don't bother. We're not covering it again.
The difference between that and this and the radio, though, is that you can't go back in time unless you're recording segments. But I mean, like, we can certainly go back and cover AWA and polygraphs again, and I'm not opposed to that at all. Just that if we constantly cover the same thing about polygraphs and early termination petitions, then it's going to be a very boring show.
Oh, I would agree with that. We would really need fresh questions. And if the people
Correct.
want to submit fresh questions, and if they want to listen to an answer that they may not agree with, because I'm going to consistently say the same thing, I'm going to say that
Yes.
we can't give legal advice, but if I were doing this as a friendly consultant, here are the things I would tell you to do and recommend that you do. And we can do that, but probably we could rotate through the different topics rather than try to do one of each one every week. We could rotate through those topics. And of course, of a month or 5 weeks, we could rotate back. And by then, you've forgotten what we said 5 weeks ago.
Yes, exactly. I think that was all the things there. And
I
we can
think
move on to
so.
the second question.
That is correct.
All right, so question number two, it says Larry always recommends that people get an attorney for every issue. I'm probably better informed on this than most any lawyer. I want to get off registration, and my state does permit petitions. Why is it that I can't just simply do a petition myself and tell my story to the judge? That's a legit question, Larry. I like that. Why can't we just tell the judge, hey, I've done these things, I've complied. Why do we need to go through the whole rigmarole of hiring an attorney for 3,500, 5 grand, 10 grand, whatever that number is, and just have the judge award us what we are asking for?
You can. You are permitted to do that. Absolutely. You can do that. And I don't recommend it because we've covered before, but here's one of those things where it probably wouldn't be bad to mention it again. To increase your odds of success on your petition for removal, you're going to need to consider a lot of factors that the average layperson hasn't been trained in considering. You may tell a great story to a judge, but it may not be a great time to tell that story to the judge because it might be 4 weeks before that judge is going to face an angry mob of voters like Judge Persky did. Therefore, an attorney might be able to guide you past that troubled period of time. The same thing would apply to the prosecution in that jurisdiction. Most of these petitions are served on the prosecution, the district attorney, the prosecuting attorney, whatever they, state's attorney, whatever they call them in that particular jurisdiction. And you may be in the midst of a high-profile case that would really sink your ship because there's been a lot of publicity, and this might not be a good time to file a petition. So therefore, those things a legal professional can help you with. The legal professional can have the conversation with the district attorney's office and find out how they're going to posture on your particular case, what their opinion is about you, and how vigorously they're going to fight against you. You're not going to be able to have that. You will be able to talk to the judge. The judge is generally going to let you make your statement and going to read your petition if you can put together a coherent petition. But it would be a whole lot better if you knew what the state was going to say before they said it, because it would help. You would be able to set yourself up with supporting evidence of maybe a psychosexual evaluation, or you might be able to call some witnesses that might offset what the state's going to say. We just don't know that. And those conversations are not going to be able to be successfully had between you and the prosecution.
I guess we could equate this to almost anything that you might do on your own, whether that's changing oil or doing something more, probably not changing oil because that's pretty simple to do, but something a little bit more heavy lifting on fixing your car. You could probably follow a manual and take apart the pieces, but there are certain levels of expertise where it's not just common unscrew this, but something more nuanced that's a little obscure that goes on when you're doing one of these things. I mean, I work in the computer field, and sure, you can do all kinds of things on your own, but at a certain point, the expertise level becomes so great that you need to call in a professional because they know a bunch of the traps and pitfalls that you're going to run into. Same thing with like you and legislation kind of things. If we talk to you and ask you questions about how a bill, what kind of traps might there be, or conversations that we need to have with an opposing politician, that your expertise kicks in those areas to tell us what kind of traps we might run into.
Absolutely. When you don't understand a game, it's really not a good arena to play in. And that's what I stress to people is this is not a game that you do very well because most people don't understand it. You might have seen some episodes of something that resembles court on television, but that is not the real world in most cases of how things are done. And when you're not when you're when the stakes are as high as they are getting off the registry, and in particular, you won't be able to file a petition again, sometimes for years. I would think you'd want to be successful.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. Anything else you want to cover there before we move on to this other note from the person?
No, I think we can move on because we're almost at our full hour now.
Oh, excellent, perfect. All right, this was. Can you tell me who wrote this? Is this from Gerald? Is that what it is?
Yes, he's in, I think he's in federal prison, if I remember right.
Okay. And I think it gets set up by reading. It says, I'm writing in hopes of dialogue and adding to the Hate Crimes Act bill to protect additional classes of people. The Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act of 2009, which extended protections to victims of crimes committed based on a person's actual or perceived sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability. Today, despite great progress for civil rights, these crimes continue in communities nationwide and in prisons, and in the U.S. Department of Justice should continue to be vigilant in its efforts to bring those who practice hate-fueled violence to justice. A lot go unreported because of fear of retaliation or death, especially in prisons. I'm asking that this bill be amended to add some of those who have been convicted of sex crimes. They are U.S. citizens and human beings, and therefore should be added to that bill for the LGBTQ community, because we people have made them to be a group because they are outcast to groups just for protection. I'm asking for your help in considering these types of people be added to that bill because of vigilantes in the prison, and out asking to add this with the Ex Post Facto Act, because this is the same as terrorism, torture, and no one should get away with harming another citizen of the United States of America just because of its crime or alleged act. We all know that the DAs only want to convict, not acquit, even though both of those are their jobs. No DA, it's a hate crime even when you set it up like that. Stop the hate in America. That last sentence is a little hard to read. I didn't quite figure out how to edit that one while I was reading it. But we get the point.
So, well, the Matthew Shepard is so old that a lot of listeners won't even remember the name, but he was a young college student in Cheyenne, Wyoming. I believe it was 1999 in that era. He was picked up in a bar. There's not a lot of gay bars anywhere in Wyoming. I'd actually be surprised if you found a single gay bar in Wyoming. But he was picked up by a couple of straight guys, and he thought he was going to go out and have a romantic evening, and they started beating him as soon as they put him in the pickup truck, and they tied him to a fence post, and they left him, and he died after being hung on a fence post outside town for some number of hours, and so that was what he's referring to, but he wrote this to the U.S. Department of Justice, to the Civil Rights Division, and I would personally be supportive of expanding hate crime protection. It generally draws a lot of resistance from the conservative side of the aisle because they say their argument is that it's already a crime to do these things, which it is. They're already against the law to beat a person and tie them to a fence post. We've already got a law for that. But what I used to miss when I used to feel the way that they feel their response is that those things are against the law, but you don't want people sitting around thinking about committing crimes and the mob mentality to sit in when they're targeting someone because of their sexual orientation or their race or all those things, because that's the most heinous thing about it. It's already heinous enough to go rob a person. prefer that you not do that. But if you're hanging out with two or three of your friends and you're drinking Bud and you're doing your Friday night things and you say, well, let's go whoop up on some whatever. I didn't want to use any of the pejoratives, but whatever. And you go out and you start targeting those people and you would not have committed a crime, but for hate of that group, that is an additional crime on top of the crime. And that's what I had trouble seeing at one time in my life. I used to buy exactly into the conservative talking point that these things are already against the law, and they are.
But I mean, just bat this around with me for a minute. Doesn't that just make it illegal-er?
Well, it does make it illegal-er, if there's any such word. But what would happen if people who are not predisposed to do crime to begin with, and the group mentality, the mob mentality, whatever you want to refer to it, if they know that their hatred of a particular group is the thing that's driving them to prison, and they wouldn't have committed the crime but for that hatred, could that be a deterrent? Maybe.
I suppose if like the young lad that was killed about a year, 18 months ago in Southeast Georgia, if that has a hate crime attached to it, does that then make it across banners across the news saying that this was being charged as a hate crime, which I'm sure it is, but does that then deter the group of people that hates the other group of people from doing those kinds of things? They're still going to hate him, Larry. I don't know that it changes that.
Well, I don't know that it does either, but the threat of a severe penalty might. If we didn't believe that penalties deterred, why do we even have penalties to start with?
I think we're just mad at them when we take them off the street.
So, do you don't think the deterrence is any factor in the equation?
I if you are a person that just hates on, you pick your subclass of people, whether that's LGBTQ, whether that's based on race, if you just hate them for that reason, I think you're just gonna hate them anyway. And I don't know what stops you necessarily from just going out and going on a rampage, but some level of human decency. I don't know that it's a deterrent. Like, oh my God, if we go do this thing, we're going to go to prison for 50 years. I don't know that that factors into the equation.
Well, that's the same argument about general deterrence that's made all the time. How much do criminal penalties deter people? I don't think I can answer that. But I
Yeah,
think that
I think it would vary from person to person.
but I think there is a deterrent factor. That's the reason why if we didn't believe that, we would not even have penalties. We would say, well, that's not going to stop anybody from doing anything.
True.
Deterrence and protection, there are some people, in addition to deterrence, you also want them not to be able to act. And if you think you can't deter them, that's a place for prison as a certainty. The criminality drops considerably when they're in prison. Not completely, but considerably because of the restricted movement.
Yes. That's funny. Yes, getting locked up would at least prevent you from doing to the general population. You could still certainly do criminal activity to that isolated group of people, but you're not going to do it to just, Grandma Jones down the street.
So,
Well, let's keep moving along then, Larry. We have an article here. The first article up is from SCOTUS blog, and it's justices won't hear Missouri inmates' request to choose firing squad over lethal injection. It looks like this story is about an individual who had, I think, a tumor removed, and he's missing a fifth of his brain. And he believes that the current concoction of the lethal injection drugs may cause him to be have severely painful and prolonged seizures during the injection. So he wants to be shot by a firing squad, and it looks like they're denying this. Is that right?
I have mixed emotions. Yes, the liberals said that they were disappointed that the conservatives didn't want to hear this case, and they dissented. But I have mixed emotions because I put it in here for the reason that I want to emphasize. People say, Larry, why don't you argue the registry is unconstitutional because it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment? And I say repeatedly, if the capital punishment, the various methods we put people to death in this country, is not cruel and unusual, it's difficult for me to conceive that anything short of that is going to be considered cruel and unusual. So here's a case where the Supreme Court the conservatives are telegraphing to you that this man may suffer lots of pain in his execution, and the cruel and unusual punishment clause is not adequate. That they don't deem that. So if torturing a person to death is not cruel and unusual punishment, I don't think registration is. That's why I put it in here. But the thing broke down liberal versus conservative in terms of the petition for cert and who voted to grant cert and who didn't.
Yeah, if we go back to 240 years ago, what was considered cruel and unusual punishment, as long as you didn't enhance the torture, you could, if you wanted to execute someone, that was okay. You just couldn't execute them slower, I guess. Like you couldn't bloodlet them. Let's, I don't know. Let's make up something. So if that's considered constitutional, then just having some people go visit the popo on an annual basis and get kind of harassed on a regular basis, that sounds like that's not nearly as bad. I agree with that. I don't agree with it, but I agree with that concept.
You understand the reasoning of the court. If you believe that we strictly interpret the words, and that's all we do, and we interpret those words based on what was accepted at that time, capital punishment was widely used in colonial times. There's no way you can conclude that it was unconstitutional and that the framers had any idea of making it unconstitutional. Therefore, you can't make a constitutional argument successfully to a textualist. The same thing on the cruel and unusual punishment clause. If you look at punishments that were acceptable at that time in that era, if you don't do any evolving as a society, then having extreme pain, even though we have means of executing people that are less painful, that's not cruel and unusual punishment.
Did it, I don't see in this that it broke down 6-3. Is that how it came down?
That was what I thought I had read. So, but our
Okay.
listeners will correct me if
I'm
I'm
looking
wrong.
for a 6-3, but I don't know. I don't see what it says. And Sotomayor wrote the dissent.
And I think it was joined by the two other two liberals. But that's all right. It's not cruel and unusual punishment. We're not going to win in our battle on cruel and unusual punishment, not as long as we have a court that's composed of the membership that we have now. I know that our audience wishes that the conservatives would be our savior, and they so many of them believe that, but they're not.
And then for clarity on how we get the nine justices that we have, I just want to make sure that it's completely clear. As presidents nominate, Senate confirms, so we would have to have a president that thinks the way that we would want to think about this kind of subject of what we would consider cruel and unusual punishment for then that person to nominate. And then we would also have to the composition of the Senate to think roughly along these lines that they would confirm those kind of judges.
Yes, and what we learned during the previous administration is that they will rush approvals through at breakneck speed when they have control of the presidency, and we learn that they will hold up confirmations and let a backlog of vacancies develop across the federal judiciary when they are in control of the Senate. We learned all of that, and it's funny, they ran against packing the court, and they did more court packing than has ever been done in our history over the
By like
40
400 judges at the federal level appointed during the previous administration.
and a lot of those, it was funny in one of the debates, and Biden was so off his game that he didn't respond, but it was mentioned in the debate, I was handed a whole bunch of vacancies, and the thing would have been to have said is, yes, you were. But it was because all confirmations were basically shut down for 2 years, and you were handed vacancies, not because the president at the time wasn't nominating judges, but the Senate wasn't confirming the nominees.
But Larry, to be fair though, I don't know that that makes it out to the general population. They don't know necessarily what the process is that the president nominates, and then the Supreme Court then confirms the judges at the federal level and at the Supreme Court level. And I guess the term is in the Constitution, it's with the advice and consent of the Senate. So the president could do all he wants, but if the Senate doesn't go along with it, Which I totally accept and like that it's not just one person making up a rule, but then you end up with a POS in the Senate named Mitch McConnell who shuts it all down and won't let anything go. Why don't they let them go on the record and go vote, and then you know whether the person in your state was one of the people that you would like or not like? They just
Well,
shut the whole thing down and didn't even hold a vote for any of them.
that is correct. And you misspoke on one of that. We'll clean up in the transcript. You said the Supreme Court confirms, the Senate confirms. But
Oh, my bad, my bad, my bad.
the advice and consent is a little bit unclear, but we have history and the precedent of how confirmations have been handled. And that's what we generally go on. And the fact that judges normally were considered, and unless they were deemed not qualified, they were given a vote. And the reason why they were not given votes in the last administration before Trump was that they would have been confirmed, because there wouldn't have been any basis to not confirm them. The same thing with Merrick Garland when he was nominated to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. Had the committee held a hearing and referred him to the floor, he would have been overwhelmingly confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. He was already sitting on a court of appeals, so he would have been confirmed.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. I understand. Well, then let's continue on, sir. And there's a next article. Same. All right, let's move over to the Marshall Project. He died like an animal. Some police departments hogtie people despite knowing the risk. This is Larry. I guess I've seen this, but there's a picture up on the screen that let me make sure that this is up there for right now. Like, people have seen this where you have your arms tied behind your back and then that's adhered to your legs that are also tied. It's something you see in like cowboy movies or something like that. I can see that this would be an effective way to restrain people, but I can't imagine that this would actually get used on a regular basis, but this article describes that they use it pretty regularly. It's very sad.
It is indeed, and these are one of the things, this would be one of the things that would be addressed in police reform, that you would prohibit these type of things, kind of like the shackling of a pregnant woman when they're giving birth,
Yes.
Putting handcuffs on a 12-year-old, 11-year-old, a kid in school, because the law enforcement apparatus, and I'm talking directly to you, law enforcement apparatus, you're incapable of making the rules yourself. And that's why we, as your employers, have to forbid you to do these things, like all employers forbid employees to do things that are not acceptable. You should not be allowed to do these things, and I will do all I can to help pass laws and support proposals that will stop you from doing things like shackling pregnant women when they're having a baby, and putting hard cold handcuffs on a child in school because he burps too loud and is disruptive in class. Those type of things are not acceptable police conduct, and you are not able to restrain yourself, so we will have to restrain you.
I didn't, I guess I didn't realize this. I didn't put the connection together that when they pull that super taut, and there's a picture up on the screen of if you are pulled cinched all the way tight and your body is at more than a 90 degree angle, that puts pressure on your diaphragm, making it very difficult to breathe. I'm like, well, yeah, that would make sense, but didn't really think about it. So it would become very uncomfortable, but I like, why couldn't they just sort of leave you immobilized, like handcuffs and ankle shackles? What are you gonna do? You can't run if you got shackles on your legs. You just can't. I don't know what you're supposed to do.
Well, you're missing parts of police training and mentality. Unfortunately, police training is driven by the threat of death. They convince these people when they're training that everybody's carrying something in their rectum, that everybody's a bad guy and is going to kill you. You won't make it home to your family. And they teach compliance, and escalation tactics are largely the way of achieving compliance. They don't teach de-escalation, they teach escalation. And this is to show and demonstrate superiority of force. You will comply, and this is what will happen when you don't comply.
Yes, I get it. It's I've said this before. It's that it's not to serve and protect. It's to dominate and oppress. That's what the police should have on their cars now, instead of to serve and protect. They should have dominate and oppress. All right, so we get hogtied. Great, cool. Should we move on?
Let's move on. This one's about public defenders, I think.
This one is: lawmakers consider bill to ensure rural counties appoint public defenders independently from the judiciary. Can you explain that to me? Because I don't understand. I don't even understand how that concept works. Defenders independent from the judiciary.
I was hoping that you could explain it because I didn't read the bill number AB 480 in Nevada, but it appears as though that they're going to try to make a more robust defense system in Utah, particularly in the rural Utah, Nevada, particularly in the rural areas where it's haphazard at best, and it's going to cost some money, and therefore that's going to make a difficult sell in the political environment. Spending money for criminal defense is just not a very popular thing that gains votes.
The thing that it would make sense to me is that there's an independent group. There's a like the public defenders of fill in the blank of state. And that would be an independently funded organization outside of the judiciary that, but as far as I know it, the public defenders work in the same building as the DA does, or at least something nearby. They're tied together. That would, to me, would create a potential conflict of interest.
Really? How so?
Yeah. Just that they are rubbing elbows together, they're having lunch together. I mean, public defenders are ridiculously overworked, but if they're a public defender should be effectively the same as a paid attorney. They're just publicly funded, and they should be there to advocate to your best defense and not part of the judicial system itself, I guess. I don't know if I'm being clear in how I'm articulating that.
So, well, I guess we can come back to this in a future episode, but if it's increasing resources for indigent defense and making it a more formal process rather than haphazard where the judge says, hey there, got this case here, would you mind taking it for me? And they point out in the article that some of the attorneys are like what we refer to as a guppy or a newbie, and they're being asked to take very serious cases, and they probably don't have sufficient experience and background to take these serious cases where so many people are facing lengthy prison sentences, including life or maybe even capital punishment. And therefore, it's important that you have robust defense and qualified defense. But no state likes to spend money on that. It's just not politically appealing. Go out and run a campaign and tell people you want to spend more money on indigent defense and tell me what kind of reception you receive.
Shoot, if you run a campaign on indigent anything, you're not going to do very well, I don't think. Okay, well then let's move along to Colorado. CBS Denver is where this comes from. Colorado District Attorney sound the alarm over bill to revamp sex offender management. This was something that someone posted in Discord, I believe, and it says a bill dealing with sex crimes has exploded in controversy at the Colorado State Capitol. District attorneys say the bill would allow some of the state's most violent PFRs to be released from prison without any treatment. And did you have any thoughts on this?
I sure do. I think it's amazing. You have a system where treatment is so underfunded, so people are in prison and they cannot get treatment, and they're trapped there. And now the district attorneys, they're crying their crocodile tears about how much they want these people to have treatment. What they really want is extended prison. And this is a convenient way to keep people in prison because, oh, we would be happy for them to be out if they had the treatment. And it's just would be a tragedy if they were released without the treatment. Of course, you're not doing anything to try to increase the budget for treatment. You're just magically
Correct.
concerned that they're not getting any treatment. Well, that is just so transparently dishonest. The way you force people to provide funding for treatment is you require them to be released when their day comes for release. Like I say about our state, when you've done your time, we don't have early release here. You do a parole period that they name parole, but you only get to that after you've done your time. We need to change our law that says on that day, you shall be released. And magically, we will start finding the funding so that we can put these people in supervised settings rather than just having them roaming the streets. But they should walk out the prison when their time is up. And I don't know the system in Colorado well enough to, but I think there's a lot of similarity. They do their time and then they have these long extended periods of supervision and they can't get out because they haven't had the treatment. They'll find the money if you start releasing them. They'll magically find the money.
I'm thinking of how things went for me in Georgia that I to make parole that I needed to complete XYZ classes. Classes did not become available to me until I was getting like ridiculously close to maxing out, forget parole, just maxing out the whole sentence. So then they magically found the space for me to get into a class so that I could max out and do the whole sentence. And I know Georgia's different than other states having split sentences with parole, probation, and then completing your whole sentence and all that. But they could have sent me through the classes to help me get out 2 years earlier, and then maybe I could have made it out on parole 2 years earlier, but they didn't.
So, well, we used to have a messed up system here where juveniles were supposed to be taken before a judge within so many hours, and that wasn't happening. And we recognized that the law said that they shall be taken before a judge, but yet the judges were not seeing them within that requisite, and I don't remember the exact number of hours. Well, I worked with a senator who said there's an easy fix for that. He said, let's just add one sentence to the law that says, if they're not taken before the judge, they shall be released. And magically, the judges will start finding a way to hear them. Well, a couple of senators that don't do criminal law, but yet are attorneys, they were saying, well, I feel uncomfortable about that because bad people might be released. He said, don't, you don't have anything to worry about. If you have it in the law that if they don't see a judge within that requisite period of time, they shall be released, the courts will find a way to see them.
But given the court not having infinite resources and infinite time, then wouldn't that push other people's cases? Wouldn't that push that back also? I mean, there's only a finite number of hours and judges and resources to handle all of this stuff anyway.
That would be true. Generally, civil cases would be pushed aside and they would have to wait their turn. We might have to look at possibly increasing judicial resources if we can't curtail the number of cases that are entering the system. Now, remember, the defense attorneys have very little to say about which cases enter the system. If you look at the system of how cases are introduced, who does the introduction of a case to the criminal justice system? Is it the defense attorney or the
It's going to be
prosecution?
most likely the DA.
Right. So
Prosecution, yeah.
the person you elect that tells you they're running on a platform of law and order, and I'm going to make you nice and safe. Remember, when you go in and you punch that name for them, you've just done the opposite of what you claim you're for. Because when they tell you that they're the law and order person, that means that they're going to prosecute everything they can get their hands on. And that's part of the problem.
I hear you. All right. Well, let's go over to the appeal. And this is how these cities are breaking up the work of police departments. I think if I was reading this right, that they were talking about, let's see if this was the right one. They were talking about changing the name of like a police force to, was it public safety or something along those lines to separate out that you have un oh, there it is. There it is. It's Ithaca's mayor made headlines in February when he proposed replacing the city's police force with armed and armed public safety officers. That's not defunding the police. That's changing that you have people that are there for aggressive situations and you have other ones that are there for de-escalating kind of situations. Sounds good to me.
Sounds good to me as well. The problem is it gets so misrepresented when you hear that term that was coined, and they're good at coining terms that resonate with people. Defund the police. They act as if that you're just gonna abolish the police and call it quits and let the criminals roam. No, that's not what anybody's talking about doing. They're talking about reallocating some of the police funding for maybe to people who are better equipped to handle things. The police get stuck with a lot of things that they'd probably rather not do. And if you could have that dialogue with the police, they would tell you, hey, we've become the social workers. We've become, I mean, you ask a jail administrator particularly, they've become the psych wards. They don't want to be a psych ward. There's a lot of police duties that police could probably do without that would be better done with someone who's not quite as threatening as a police officer can be to those who are in stress in their life, mental stress. But we're not really going to be able to have that conversation because the defund, anti-defund is so convincing
Yeah.
that it's so much hyperbole there that I don't think we can. There's so many things that we really can't have an honest discussion about in this country because you get vilified for trying to do so.
Totally. Just like the ad we played a week or two ago that you were talking about just a little while ago on this episode. But we played that clip from, I don't remember the guy's name, but was bashing the other person for the something something bill. We gotta pass the something bill in Congress.
And in fact, that election is happening
So,
on
anyway,
Tuesday, and it was the Breathe Act,
fair.
and he said that
Okay.
we would let rapists and murderers, child molesters free, and that she would want to close all federal prisons within 10 years. The only thing about that is nobody's talked about closing all federal prisons within 10 years, and the federal prisons have very few rapists, very few murderers, very few child molesters because those are all state crimes. Nobody
Right,
understands that
right, right,
though.
right, right.
Nobody understands that though. So all the people will run out and vote for him because his opponent is going to close the federal prisons and release rapists and murderers and child molesters, which there are very few in federal prison.
God, you'd have, I bet you'd have to do like, I mean, just like Nasser. I don't think he made it to federal
He
prison
didn't.
e
He
for,
didn't. He didn't
he's
because
in,
he didn't.
he's Minnesota, Michigan,
Michigan.
right?
Yeah, he didn't commit any federal crimes.
And Sandusky also.
Or Dennis Hastert. Or on and
So
on.
these are people that have ridiculous numbers of victims that came forward and they end up at the state level. So I'm just supporting the comment you made about the argument that that particular politician made. It was being dishonest about supporting this act, and letting all these people out, tidal wave of crime, blah, blah, blah. But it's at the state level that this would only impact people anyway. All right, so over at Courthouse News, Texas governor signs law banning reality TV crews from filming police. Larry, I gotta get my daily cop drama show on, Bad Boys, and all that. Why would we sign bills that stop this from happening? That doesn't make sense. I want my entertainment.
I don't know. I just thought it'd be funny to put it in here because I have the feeling that the police don't like being watched.
I think the police like being watched when they get to go be a badass and they get their 15 seconds of fame. I bet you they like it from that point of view.
So, well, I don't know the background of this. Our Texans can tell us what the backstory is, but I don't know how you can actually stop them from filming. You may be able to stop them from distributing it, but in terms of filming, I think that you have the right to film the police. I think that's been pretty well established.
And we know that the young lady that filmed the George Floyd event, she just sat there on the sidelines and filmed away. I bet you can film them. And but I, Larry, to then to counter my own argument, the police have come by and taken cameras from people. I've heard reports of that where they say you can't film us. And you could certainly like follow them around. You don't have to get, you'd have to get releases. But so let me fill in another part of this. If you go back to a program on the media from WNYC, 6-ish, maybe 6 months ago, maybe 12 months ago, they did a program about this subject, pretty in depth. It's I think it's like a 20-minute long segment. There's a revenue split between the cop drama shows and then with the local police department, which I gotta think that so they're driving on ratings And if they get more exciting car chases or chasing people down dark alleys and whatnot, the more people would tune in, which would drive more revenue to the police department, which, like, they would be incentivized to potentially escalate a situation. To me, that seems like a conflict of interest.
I don't know enough about that to know about revenue splits and whatnot, but I do know that police used to, when cameras were much larger,
Sure.
when you had your camcorder,
Yeah.
the police were much more likely, because there were so few of them, they were expensive. You really can't do it as easily. Plus, the body of case law has evolved to protect those who are videoing the police. But that was a routine thing. They would confiscate it and say, "This is evidence in a criminal investigation. We're gonna have to
Right.
seize this camera and the video that you shot." Well, the truth of the matter is, they didn't want that video out there. That's why they seized it.
Sure. Yeah, totally. I'm with you. All right, well then, let's move over to a Washington Post article. It says Louisiana lawmakers reject non-unanimous jury's relief bill. So as I understand it, there was God, we covered it in the last couple of weeks, something with the Supreme Court, and there were only two states, as I recall, Louisiana and Oregon were the last two states to hold out that you could be convicted of super duper like murder kinds of crimes in a non-unanimous jury. So 11 of 12 jurors could convict you, and that would send you to life in prison. And then as I read this, Louisiana lawmakers Thursday blocked an effort to offer a path to release for an estimated 1,500 prisoners convicted of felonies by juries that were not unanimous. So the Supreme Court says that, didn't they say that you have to have a unanimous jury for those kind of crimes?
They did, but it's not retroactive.
Right, I'm with you. So, but then these people are asking to have some sort of relief applied based on that ruling, and they said no.
No, this was that. That is correct. This is a liberal Democrat named Randall Gaines who sponsored legislation to apply this, and it could release, I think, if the article is accurate, 1,500 prisoners that were convicted by non-unanimous juries. Now, this is the hypocrisy of the whole. See, the conservatives, they're the stewards of fiscal responsibility, you see, and
I've heard this.
they don't want government any bigger than it has to be. Yet, and they're the constitutionalists, you understand, all these things that they tout. Well, so now the Supreme Court has said you can't convict anybody prospectively with a non-unanimous jury. Well, if you can't do it prospectively, it stands to reason that you shouldn't have been doing it in the past. Here's a chance for you to demonstrate your true conservative values. You have a prison system in Louisiana that's overcrowded, underfunded, and you've got all the political cover you possibly could need. You've got a Supreme Court of the United States saying that you shouldn't do this, shouldn't have been doing this, although they didn't make it retroactive. You can't do it going forward. So you can clean out 1,500 out of your prisons. But rather than demonstrating your true conservative values, you blocked it. You blocked it. Why? Are you really about cutting government down to size? Or is that just political jargon?
Tell me what, like, for real though, do you have any insight? What is your opinion of the mindset of why they would block this? If so, obviously it's not about money. Is it about just keeping the prison industrial complex fully loaded?
Yes, it would have been the law enforcement industrial complex, like the DAs we talked about in a previous segment. They would be against it. It would have, without being, you would have to develop the public to understand it. It would require some leadership that people don't want to provide when it comes to criminal justice. Someone would have to stick their head up out of the tall grass where politicians like to stay laying low. They would have to say, "Look, we were doing this wrong all these years, and I'm willing to take the political risk. We should let these people go." And even though normally you don't get vilified if you're a conservative, there is that risk that within your own party you might get vilified because, as we've been noticing in the not too distant past, sometimes you're not conservative enough and you get pushed
Yeah.
aside. And so therefore they could be fearing a conservative backlash of if they take these types of risks. That would be my guess, not being in Louisiana. But the Louisianans, who are so much more brilliant than the rest of the country, Southerners take great pride of how much smarter they are than the rest of the country and how brilliant they are when it comes to applying common sense. Hold your elected officials in the Louisiana House of Representatives accountable. Tell them this goes against your values of the Constitution about guilty, only guilty upon unanimous juries, and that it also goes against your values of spending money that shouldn't be spent. These people shouldn't be in prison because they should never have been convicted on a non-unanimous jury. Tell them that. That helps give them political cover. Let them hear from you. Of course, I know no one's going to call, but that's what would give these people the incentives would be if they would hear from the constituents. We're not happy with you for killing this.
I gotcha. Bizarre. All right. Moving on over to an Associated Press article. Prosecutors sue over California prison good conduct rules. You put this in here for some crazy reason, I'm sure.
The same reason we had the other article in there about the DAs. This is an example of the law enforcement industrial complex. They do not want the prison population to go down. This would put more people eligible for good time, as I understood it, and we just can't have that.
And but so we were just bashing on Republicans. Isn't California mostly a blue legislative state?
That's why we're bashing on them as well, because this is not a partisan issue. I keep saying, and for some reason, people don't believe me, Registry Matters and FYP is not partisan. We're about good public policy. It doesn't matter whether the state is Republican or Democrat. If you're doing something wrong, now apparently the California legislature is trying to do the right thing and they're getting pushback from the district attorneys. Okay, that's fine. Then you need to be electing different district attorneys. But we need to call it the way we see it. That's why this is in here.
I'm just reading something here, and I think I've known some people that were firefighters in Georgia, but I recall California being overrun with wildfires, at least if it was not last year, it was 2 years ago. And those individuals were there on the front line getting paid pennies to fight these fires, and then they would be released from prison, and then they would not be eligible to work for the fire department to go fight wildfires, even though they were able to do it when they were effectively doing like slave labor, Larry. And but I would think that we would want those kind of people to receive exorbitant amounts of good time for putting their life on the line to actually save homes and people's lives and property and all that stuff in the state. We would bestow all kinds of good time credits on that particular profession, but I would think that we would also want them to have those kind of jobs on their way out the door. But here we go. Prosecutors sue over California prison good conduct rules.
Yeah,
Love it.
and well, the thing is, now I don't know California politics well enough to be precise, but I can tell you this: if you've got 58 district attorneys, according to the article, and 44 are suing, I don't believe that 44 of those would be from Republican districts. I think that as blue as California is, that's a lot of district attorneys from blue districts, and therefore, they need to be called out. You're not the progressive that you probably ran claiming that you're going to effectuate change if every time you have the opportunity to do some change, you file lawsuits and you oppose it. So therefore, there should be no hate mail. We just called out the conservatives and we just called out the liberals.
We'll probably get it anyway.
So.
Right, well, let's move over to reason. Baton Rouge cops strip searched a minor during a traffic stop and entered a family's home without a warrant. The city just settled for $35,000. Larry, that does not sound like enough money. The case is an indictment on just how hard it is to get accountability when the government violates your rights. What is your point here?
I think I was smoking some wacky weed. I think it's just a police accountability. I was putting some filler in here. It is a low amount of money. And the thing that struck my attention was the federal judge called them out for that. This officer has had multiple times with difficulty. This wasn't his first encounter. And all we want is police accountability. We know that no group of human beings is going to be perfect, and we know that. We just need to hold them accountable. When you watch the video, I found it relatively disturbing.
All right. So then we'll move over to the final article before we close the show out. And this is from news-journal.com. Never heard of this one, but someone in the chat posted this one on the Discord server. It said, man charged in 2018 murder in Longview gets 99 years for failure to register as a PFR. That is a lot of time for failure to register, Larry.
Well, I don't know what you want me to do with that one. It's
We
where
beat it around for a few minutes during pre-show. What does it mean potentially for him for it to say? So it says this is the third time Kellogg, the person that got the sentence, failed to register as a PFR. The assistant district attorney said Thursday during closing arguments of the sentencing phase of the trial. Third time to re failure to register? Didn't you have some ambiguity there?
Well, what I said, I'm not sure where this jurisdiction is. Where is Longview? Where are we talking about?
Where are we talking about? You keep talking for a minute, and I'll try and find where we're talking about.
So what I was talking about in the pre-show was that when you say failure to register, that usually is misleading. It's often a technical violation, some issue of noncompliance, where a person was registered but they didn't report something within the 3 days. A job change, a vehicle change, something of that nature. That's not the same thing and should not be treated with the same severity if someone just didn't register at all. The news media doesn't bother to find out and report to the public if the person had a technical violation or if they just flat out were not registering. That would be very helpful, news media, if you would tell us if the person failed to register at all or if they failed to update some paperwork. That would change the level of severity. But my other point would be in terms of the crime, if you didn't have these laws on your books, they would not be able to impose them. We do not have the potential for that to happen in my state. Since registration is a civil regulatory scheme, it's not eligible for the Habitual Offender Act, although our Habitual Offender Act has never had anyone successfully prosecuted under it for the 25 years it's been on the books. No one has ever been sentenced to life to prison in prison. But our civil regulatory scheme, it is a fourth degree felony carrying a nine, an 18-month maximum. If you have a previous conviction for failure to comply, it elevates to a third degree felony, and it has a whopping 3-year maximum sentence. So that's all he could get here. It's not eligible for any type of enhancement beyond the internal enhancement. That means that
It is Texas, by the way.
you people in Texas need to change your law. You need to exempt this civil regulatory scheme. This is the reason why you need to argue it's a civil regulatory scheme. You need to exempt this civil regulatory scheme from your Habitual Offender Act because this is a civil regulatory scheme. It should be treated like a person who drives without a valid driver's license. The punishment would get more severe, but they would never get 99 years. But also, you should put something in your statute that makes it clear that failure to register altogether is not the same as failing to comply with a particular nuance of registration.
And what you're saying there is someone is still living at the same address, still driving the same car, license hasn't changed, and they forget to whatever, they don't register, but they didn't go move to a new address trying to like evade the system. They just like, oops, sorry, I forgot. But all the data is still the same.
I can make it more heinous than that. Say a person has a job and they lose their job. And they're all distraught about losing their job because they can't support their family. And the law says that you shall report within 48 or 72 hours any change in your employment status. Well, you're too worried about trying to get a job so you can keep food on the table and you don't get in within 72 hours. That's a failure to comply. You could conceivably get the same penalty for failure to report that you're no longer working there because that is a change in your job status, right?
Yeah, totally.
They prosecute people for that here.
Okay, sure. And a person in chat says, indeed, I had a technical violation. I forgot to update my phone number, forgot I even registered it, caught it when I was signing the form. He said, we don't play those gotcha games. So at least not everyone sucks. The key is if they were looking for something to pin on me. There you go. They don't care currently. But if they do want to get get me for something. There it is.
So, but yeah, it's really sad that they put so much emphasis on this civil regulatory scheme to play the I got you, and they do play the I got you. You may have some departments that don't, but too often that's what they do. They place an extraordinary amount of resources into tracking to see if they have an I got you moment because the penalties are so extreme.
Gotcha. Larry, that closes out the articles for the evening, and we are like right at an hour. We
Fantastic.
did a fine job of moving these things along. Should I play the teaser that I released to the patrons? Should I do it or should I not do it?
I think you should play it because they're going to see what a musician you are and what a treat they're going to have when we reach 100.
It was more like a musician that I was some time ago. Hopefully this will work. I will give it a shot. The whole point of that was that, so when we reach 100 patrons, then you have requested a song, then I put out a questionnaire to people on Patreon to see which song that they would like me to play. I'm way out of practice, as you may be able to tell from that. But that was a teaser that I have said I was a musician a long time ago, and I did not lie.
Well, I am sure that when we get ready for you to play on the stage with thousands of people listening around the world, that you will have practiced and you will be playing at the highest level that could be imagined.
I will get there. So now that we are in striking distance, I will be practicing on a regular basis to get my chops back up so that I don't embarrass FYP and me especially. And definitely not you. I don't want to embarrass you either.
So.
And with that, Larry, as far as new patrons, we did have a pretty substantial increase from Chris for his support. And people are renewing their membership and doing the annual thing, which I think is fantastic. You get a little bit of a perk of a discount by doing it that way. And I don't know, you didn't tell me if anybody subscribed to the other method of doing it, like by the mail. But did anybody do that?
We did not. We are receiving inquiries. People are taking advantage of the opportunity for a sample, and we're gladly sending out the sample transcripts. And we know that the podcast is more expensive than anything else you're probably subscribing to. Well, maybe not Prison Legal News, but then again, I don't even know what they charge anymore. But we realize that. But it's a weekly infusion into your life. It's not like you have to wait a month, or it's not like you have to wait every 2 months or 3 months. It's a regular weekly infusion into your life.
I like it. I think it's fantastic. If you want to find any show notes or anything, you can find us over at registrymatters.co. I would certainly encourage you to find a podcast app on your cell phone and find the podcast in that podcast app and subscribe to it. That way, when we release the show, it comes out at midnight on Tuesdays. That is like 11:59 p.m. on Monday night is actually when I release it. But you'll have it for your, if you're driving to work, but for your working time on Tuesday, you'll have the podcast available to you. And otherwise, you can leave voicemail and you can find all that stuff over at registrymatters.co. And of course, Patreon.com/registrymatters. That is our favorite way for you to support the podcast. And Larry, I don't think I have anything else that we need to c cover tonight. And with that, I will let you go and have a great weekend.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Talk to you soon. Bye bye.
You've been listening to FYP.